Excision number 21650, reel 2.
George Gardner, reel 2.
After you'd had the shower, you itched. And one of the main complaints on board was what they called itch, Dolby itch. It was caused through washing your clothes in salt water. I mean, they dried, but the salt was in the material. And when you wore it, it got in your skin and you finished up. You couldn't sleep at night, you itched that much. They sold a lot of calamine lotion. We could get it from the sick bay, but it was better to buy it from the canteen, and that eased it a lot. Living conditions, we'd 16 men in a room, I should say 5 yards the length, 10 yards by 4, there were 16 men. Your hammock was slung from the overhead bulkhead every night. You had two hooks belonged to you. They were permanently fixed in the bulkhead, which you slung your hammock on. When you was in your hammock, it was touching the hammock next to it. And as the ship gently rolled, all the hammocks rolled together. It was a good, comfortable sleep. But I wouldn't say the living conditions was very good. But you put up with it. Then we arrived.
As you were saying about the number in your mess, I think.
16 men. And one leading hand in charge of 16 men. You all had different duties every day, the same as you were. If you were the cooks of the mess, you went up to the galley and brought the meals down and served it out in 16 places on plates for the rest of the lads when they come in for their dinner. At tea time, it was a slice of bread. We used to get the loaf and cut it into 16, and then your jam, butter and jam, and a cup of tea, which was made in what they called a big tin kettle, a fanny, and the tea was made in that every day and poured it out. You could have as many cups of tea as you wanted, it would tell a lot. Milk was always condensed milk, there was never any fresh milk or anything like that. Sugar, there was sugar, right? We were allocated so much sugar, and that went after about 3 days. The rest of the week, you had to drink it without sugar.
Did you drink or to accept tea?
Yes, you could go up to the galley and drink what they call goffers, which was just lime juice. Sometimes it orange juice, but it was sweet, and it was, when we had no sugar, it was a nice drink. We got ratot every day, which was 3-in-1, what they call 3-in-1. On battleships, they don't give neat rum. They give you 3 parts water and 1 tot of rum in the water, which was looked forward to, and that was served at 11 o'clock every morning.
What effect did that have on you?
Made you tired. You used to have a drink, and if it was very hot, same as it is now, you used to, after dinner, was always making mend at sea for those not on watch, so you could sleep. But we always slept on the upper deck in the afternoon. Everybody had a little piece of canvas, what they used to lay out on the deck, and they'd lie down on that after they'd had their rum and have a nap or something, or else do your washing. You had a bucket to wash in. There was no wash. There was washrooms, but they weren't. At sea, more likely than not, they were full of water. Water got in through the bilges and it was sweeping about in the shower rooms. Only in harbour did they pump it out. You couldn't have a decent shower. You were stood up to there in water, up to your knees in water before you started to have a shower, which wasn't, you didn't like that because everybody's dirty water was falling into that. So we used to get a bucket of water and have a wash on the upper deck, which was better, you know, just a wash. At night time it used to be a lot cooler, but you used to go on the upper deck a lot at night to stop yourself from itching. It still bothered you a lot, did that itching, this Dolby rash, what they call it. And if you got a cool breeze at night, it was a lot better. And I've gone up there many a night and stood there until I couldn't stand any longer and gone down to my hammock and got in. But you no sooner got in your hammock than they were changing watches. And then there used to be three times a night they'd change watch, 4 hours each, 4 hours on, 8 hours off. That was at cruising stations. When they was at action stations, it was, well, it was all on all the time, but there was a action stations and a battle station, which was 4 hours on and 4 hours off. That was half the crew on duty and half the crew off duty. So there were 4 hours on, 4 hours off, which at the end of the week, you were absolutely dead tired. Now, when you went on watch, same as if you were a lookout, you were sat on a little chair with your glasses fixed on a pedestal in front of you, and you had a quarter of the sea to cover and a quarter of the sky. But you'd no sooner you got your eyes to the binoculars and they were ready for closing. You were tired. It used to be a fight to keep your eyes open, to keep a good lookout. But we managed it, and I would rest up there. One of the lads would lay down on the floor and to the ones that keep lookout for him, you know. But
what was the difference between battle station and action station?
Action station, all the crew was turned up. All the crew turned to. Even cooks and Royal Marines, Royal Marine Band, they all had their places on the ship. The Royal Marines had always looked after X turret. There was four turrets, A, B, Y and X. And the Royal Marines always had X turret. Seamen had the other three turrets. But action stations was all the crew were there. Battle stations was like a cruising station, 4 hours on, where you weren't so far off action stations. You were 4 hours on, 4 hours off, but you had to be ready at any time.
Were you satisfied with the food that you got?
Yes. Yes, we always got good food. We could have eaten more, because we're only young lads. But now as I look back, it was ample what they gave us. But you could have always eaten extra. The first thing you did when you went ashore was go for something to eat. That was the main thing, finding somewhere to eat. And
were you ever bored aboard ship?
No, there was always something going on. They had a headmaster on board ship. Officer. He taught the midshipmen things and also younger members of the crew. He'd teach us politics. Might take us one afternoon on politics at home, you know, what was happening at home. He must have got the news from somewhere. He was very good, and he organised a lot of games, deck quoits, which they played on board ship. Tombola, that was played, that's like a game, well, that was first bingo. They play that a lot in the Navy, Tom Bowler.
What did he tell you about politics?
How the war was going. What Mr. Churchill had done. What he'd been. How he'd changed party two or three times. He didn't try to make you believe in anything, like Labour or Conservative. He just told you the news from home, a lot of news from home. He taught you welfare. He'd tell you what you could get if your parents were ill or anything like that. He also told me for every shilling extra I allotted home, the Navy would make it two shilling. It'd increase it by 50%. So I did this, and it was not, I told my dad, I wrote him and told him what I'd done. And after about 9 months, he wrote back, he said, there's nothing happened, George, at all at this end, there's no extra money come through. He said, so I'm going to do something about it. Well, I never gave it any thought what he was going to do. But about a month later, there was a call made on board ship, Able Seaman Gardner, report to the captain's office. Now, That was the only thing you reported to the captain's office for, was something was deadly wrong. You'd done something wrong. So I got my cap. You had to have your cap to go down to the office. And I got to his office and knocked on the door. Come in. Abel Seaman Gardner reporting, sir. Oh, yes. Why have you been writing to your MP? I said, I don't even know who my MP is, sir. I've never written to one. He said, only we've had a letter from Mr. Churchill's secretary about your money, back pay that you had, your father's not received. Oh, I said, my father's written. Well, he said, he's written to Mr. Churchill. Oh, I said, well, he always did go to the top if there was anything wrong. And he'd written to Churchill. Churchill had got in touch with the ship and told them to book their ideas up and get this man's pay made right as his father was bedridden. About 2 weeks later, he got the money and everything. So it just showed, didn't it? And I never forgot that.
Did you suffer any consequences?
No, no. No, they couldn't do anything to me. I hadn't written to a... You're not allowed to write to an MP while you're in the forces. And I hadn't written to the MP, but my father had. Did you tell your father to write to the MP? I said, no, never in this world. I wouldn't say anything like that. He said, well, he must have done it on his own accord. But he hadn't written to the local MP. He'd written to Churchill himself, which got the matter sorted out quickly. That got that made right anyhow. And I was saying, then we arrived in Mombasa. That was the start of the Eastern Fleet. They were trying to build a fleet up, which was useless, really.
Why?
We were the only modern battleship there, the Warspite. There was an old one came out, Revenge. There was a carrier, an old carrier, came out with two Dutch destroyers, two Polish destroyers, and three English destroyers. And to me, that was the fleet. Well, after we'd been at Mombasa about a week, we set sail then for Trincomalee, Colombo. What is it now? It's a different name altogether.
Sri Lanka.
And we got to Trincomalee. About 2 days before we got to Trincomalee, the Japanese bombed it. Sank the carrier. What was the carrier's name?
Hermes?
Hermes, yes. And they also sank a monitor. An old monitor ship that was there, which they thought was a battleship. But we didn't have any trouble. We got into Sri Lanka. And then we sailed round to the port of Colombo itself. And from there, we went up to, from Colombo, we went across to India.
Whereabouts in India?
The capital. What's the capital called?
You don't mean Calcutta?
No.
Well, the capital's inland.
No, this was a big port.
Oh, Karachi?
No.
Bombay?
We arrived in Bombay. We could smell Bombay 3 miles out to sea. It absolutely stank. The place was absolutely... Oh, the people there, they were... I've never seen anything like it, and I've never seen as many people in my life. There must have been millions lived there. And the beggars on the street, they were professional beggars. They told us about them. They'd have their arms fastened to their side of their neck from birth, so that they were permanently walking around like that. Or their legs strapped up at back of them to make them look like they had one leg. But it had been strapped there since birth and they couldn't lower it. And all they did were hold out their hands, saying, Bakshi, Bakshi, you know. But from India we were invited to a party at the governor's residence. And outside, it was a magnificent sight, were the Bengal Lancers. They were the guards there. And Admiral Somerville had arranged this party for the troops, for the lads to go to. About 200 of us went, and it was a real nice time we had there.
And what it was did the they do for you?
They kept provided us with a meal, little delicacies that we'd never seen before, and the first time I've ever drunk and I've drunk iced tea. They drank a lot of iced tea there, and it was very nice. And then the Bengal Lancers gave a display of horsemanship. That was about it. Then we came back, but it had been a nice day out for us in nice surroundings. Then from Bombay we came down to Kutachori Store. We came down to back to Mombasa. And we'd only in Mombasa a few hours when we set sail then for Durban in South Africa. Pardon me. When we got to Durban, we were told we were entitled to a fortnight's leave to go ashore and go to the Women's Voluntary Service. Off of the ship's company. Off stayed on board, off went on leave. I went to the voluntary service and they said, would you like to go to a farm inland? I said, yes. So they gave me my train warrant for the train and said there'd be somebody waiting for me at the other side. And I went to a place called Newcastle. Oh, it was about... Well, it was 24 hours by train inland. And there I arrived at the farm. And before up the farm, I asked the farmer there, Mr. Geldart, where his boundaries were. And it turned out it was nearly as big as Lancashire. I can't tell you how big his farm was, and he only grew mealy, like corn on the cob, which was the main staple diet down there for the blacks. He'd about 36 Zulus working for him, and each one had a mud hut, a nice place, and a piece of ground, I should say, the size of Hyde Park, for working for him. Plus 10 shilling a month. And it was, they had a nice life at the Zulus, and there was, the Zulu girls worked at the big bungalow, the farm. He had about 8 working there for him, doing all the jobs. I had a horse, I could go out riding every morning. I'd always to take a dog with me. And when I got off the horse, I had to follow the dog. If the dog went off the path, I had to go off the path. There was that many snakes on his land. And it was right, I'd walk along and the dog would come off the path, and in the path there would be a snake, just fast asleep, but the dog would walk round it, we had to walk round it. Anyhow, one day he came to me, the farmer, he said, what are you doing this afternoon? I said, nothing at all. I said, I've been playing round here, messing about with the land and looking at trees. He said, well, first of all, I want you to come and have a look at a tree we have growing. He said, I've never seen one like it in South Africa. You might have them at home in England, he said. Come and have a look at it. So anyhow, we rode out. We got on the horses and rode out to this tree. When we got there, it was a common hawthorn tree. And he was looking after it. It was a prized possession, was this tree. It was the only one on his land. Anyhow, I told him what it was, hawthorn tree. And how they grow, I said, they grow all over in England. There's hedges, there's all kinds. And incidentally, his parents came from Yorkshire. And they hadn't known what it was.
Whereabouts in Yorkshire?
Well, I don't know exactly, but they were Yorkshire people that had gone out in the first place. And he had 2 sons, and they were both working in the coal mines. They were supervisors in the coal mines. They didn't work in the coal mines, they supervisors of blackies in the coal mines. But I never saw his sons, he never came home while we were there. And then one afternoon, one of the Zulu girls came running up to the camp, up to the bungalow. She said her husband was mistreating her. He'd been beating her with a whip. And she said he'd only just come back from the missionary school. The missionaries had been teaching him. So Mr. Geldart got on the phone to the local police, said, what am I to do about this? this chap's beating his wife, and I got the biggest surprise of my life. The police just said, shoot him. I said, what are you going to do? He said, we'll go over. He said, and he got his big 12 bore down and fastened it to his saddle, and we went over. I said, you're not going to shoot the fella, surely. He said, I don't think I'll have to do. He said, by now he'll know I'm coming. And as we got to the girl's mud hut, they were cycling away in the distance with her husband going hell for leather on his bicycle. He said, he'll not come back again. He said, it's... Well, I said, I couldn't have stopped with you if you were going to shoot this fella for that. He said, well, the police are very strict here against the blackies. This was them days. And it was a fact. On the buses, there was a seat upstairs, the back seat upstairs, L3 people, and that was for blacks only. The rest of the bus was white. If the bus was empty, there's still only three blackies allowed on that. It was terrible ways they treated them. The seats in the parks and all like that. Whites and Europeans. Europeans and blacks. And the blackies couldn't sit on those seats. They couldn't walk on the side when we were walking on the side. That was in them days. And it altered when the Americans came in and they started coming in Durban. Because they reckoned they weren't Europeans and they weren't blacks. So what have we to do? So the sign was taken down then. Blacks not allowed. Europeans and Americans could walk on the same side. It was very strict like that.
What did the attitude of South African blacks seem to be?
Well, the Zulus were the friendliest people I've ever met. And they were right... they were right... They liked to joke. One afternoon he said to me, he said, Mr. Geldart on the farm, he said, go down to the bottom of one of the fields. He said, there's a lot of them down there, the Zulus. He said, they're turning the field over, ploughing it, ready for planting. He said, keep them going. He said, they're good workers, he said, but they stop and talk and laugh and all like that. I said, what, me keep them going? He said, when they see you, he said, they'll know I've sent you down to keep them going, keep an eye on them. So I went down in this field, there was a big tree, and it was a very hot day, so I thought I'll get under the tree out in the shade. And there was a big pile of sacks there, so I sat on these sacks. And one of the Zulus come across, you like a drink, boss? Oh, I said, I wouldn't mind. Millet beer, would you like? It was a big jug of, it was like milk, millet beer. So I had a couple of drinks, it was good stuff. I had another couple of drinks. Next thing you know, Mr. Geldart, the farmer's giving me a shake. He said, I thought you came down here to look after them. He said, they're wise to every move I make, he said, these lads. And they just stood there grinning at him, you know. There was no harm in them. And he treated his blackies well. He did treat them well. They were part of the family on the farm. But he didn't do anything like that in the town.
Why not?
Well, straight away you'd have been ostracised. You're not allowed to mix with the blacks, only on your own property. We had a dance. We were given the worst part when we were leaving Durban. Was having a dance, giving a dance to the people that had helped us. Well, they asked 400 girls from the Lux. There was a big soap factory in Durban, Lux. Soap factory, to come to the dance, and not one of them was allowed into the dance. They were all mixed race. They were all coloured. So that the dance wasn't a success. Well, they were very strict. The South Africans were very strict on their own people. We tried to ease it off a bit, but it didn't make any difference. You couldn't do anything. Right, from Durban, we left Durban. The lady in white saw us off. Have you heard about the lady in white?
Can you tell me about her, please?
She used to stand at the end of the pier and welcome every ship into Durban and see every ship that left and sing to them. She was a South African lady. Somebody said she'd lived in Vienna, but she'd come to live in South Africa. An ex-opera singer, and she used to sing to every ship that came in and left harbour. She was known as the Lady in White. She always dressed in white.
What did she sing?
They were mostly operas. And some of the numbers that Vera Lynn used to sing, you know, songs that the ordinary Matlow knew about. But she was really good. She had a megaphone, not a microphone, one of those old-fashioned megaphones she used to sing through. And we could hear her quite well. And the ship always saluted her as she went out. As we went out of harbour, all the ship's company saluted her.
How did they salute her?
Off caps. As the ship passed, to give a hoot on the thing, and we'd all take our caps off. And she was a real grand person. And she'd wave us until we were really out of sight. But she met every ship that came in and every ship that went out. Really good. And from there we came back, we sailed all the way, we came back into the Mediterranean. Straight to Malta. And that was where the fun really started. There was air raids every night, but we used to leave Salima and come out of Malta Harbour and go around to a bay around the far side of the island, St. Paul's Bay. Then we had a bit of manoeuvrability and we could fire our guns without doing any damage to the property on Malta. And from Malta we'd sometimes take empty convoy back to Alexandria. When the convoy was right, we'd bring a convoy from Alexandria back to Malta. Sometimes we'd go leave the convoy and go and bombard North Africa, Benghazi or Tobruk, one of those places. Bombard. But we always finished up at Malta. And after we'd been there, it was the terrible things ashore in Malta. You went ashore for a meal in Malta, and the only thing you could get was lettuce and tomato. Nothing else. They were starving, literally starving. Every ship that came in, down to the docks to unload it, all the population had helped. Seemed to be people coming from Malta, and they all seemed to live in rocks, caves in the rocks. There was a lot of, well, it's a big sandstone island, is Malta, really. And they were mostly living underground. But it took a terrific punishment.
Did any air raids occur whilst you were there?
Oh, yes. Did be air raid every night. But we used to open up with the 4-inch, and we never used anything else but 4-inch. The Oricans, we could only fire two to 3,000 yards. Well, the planes were flying higher than that. Every ship in the harbour had opened fire. And when it was a quiet night, we were very wary then of the Italian two-man submarines. They'd been trying to get into Malta Harbour. Well, we used to send a boat out every night from the ship, a motorboat, with a crew of about five. And there'd be a torpedo man in the motorboat. And he had little canisters, like little depth charges. And they'd patrol up and down just outside the harbour. There were nets across the harbour entrance to stop anything coming in. But they'd patrol outside the other side of the nets. And every now and again he'd drop one of these charges over the side. And it was just like a little depth charge going off. One night, one of the depth charges, he lit the fuse and he didn't see it burning. He couldn't see it burning, so he put it back in the box. The next morning we went out to tow the boat in. It was nearly sinking. All the crew had gone. They were all killed. All the lot had blown up, all the box had blown up. So that was five killed in Malta that night. We went to sea to bury them at sea. One lad, the Sunday before, he'd had his marriage bands called on board ship. He was going to get married when he got home. And he had his marriage bands called on board ship, hoping that he was going home and he could get married when he got home. But he never made it.